My name is Yasmin Mia. I'm a physician at Mount Sinai Hospital, and I run a free clinic for the uninsured, which I founded in 2004 with the medical students at Mount Sinai.
The practice of medicine begins with the care for another person, a passion for science and research, and a fascination with the beauty and mystery of the natural world.
And there we see predominantly the uninsured of East Harlem. They range in age from 22 to quite elderly, but the common denominator of all of them is basically that they lack health insurance.
On this podcast, we will hear from the medical professionals themselves, sharing their struggles and successes, bringing us into the ORs, ERs, and ICUs across the nation.
And then I also am part of a house call program called the Visiting Doctors Program, which I've also been with since about that time, maybe a little bit earlier, 2003. And I see patients in their homes, and they are all quite debilitated, either by mental or physical illness, usually a combination of both. And they range in age also from quite young to quite elderly. The majority of our patients are obviously quite elderly.
Paging Dr. Zahos. Dr. Zahos.
Welcome to the real stories of a life in medicine. Welcome to the Life Medical.
Meet Dr. Yasmin Mia, director of the East Harlem Free Clinic at Mount Sinai, New York City.
This past experience has been profoundly transformative, to say the least. I have seen patients who have been impacted by COVID in their homes and strangely either recover or have passed away. And then during my deployment on the hospital wards, I've seen patients who have been irrevocably transformed by this horrific disease and have ranged in age anywhere from their early 30s to their late 90s. Those that have impacted me, I think, the most are those who have been in their 30s, 40s, and 50s who have seemed to be ravaged by not simply the lung effects of this disease, but the entire body has been sort of taken over by a profound and debilitating immune response to the SARS-CoV-2 virus. I have seen patients who I had thought were far older than I was told in the records. I've seen patients who seemed okay on admission, seemed to be tolerating oxygen at a fairly low level, who had to be rapidly escalated and then quite profoundly decompensated. And then those who really surprised me, who made it just by mere actions of proning them or turning them on their stomachs to calm patients down who are feeling such profound shortness of breath. These were things that I exercised in the hospital really because we were grasping at straws, not knowing what was going to work, what wasn't going to work, and opting for a palliative approach, which surprisingly in many cases actually worked, actually decreased the respiratory drive and actually improved some patients far more than I thought they would. I have seen such devastation and so many lives lost, and so many lives lost not just through death, but through a loss of function. 50-year-olds who were bicyclists, no longer able to stand up and walk again. Patients who were previously employed as pharmacists, nurses, who would probably never make it out of the hospital again. And because of the cyclical nature of my deployment, 4 days on, 4 days off, it was often hard to see how things would truly transpire in the long term. And so during the surge, what I saw was complete devastation and not necessarily patients ever leaving the hospital, or at least no real sense that they ever could.
Welcome to the latest episode of The Life Medical. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Zahos. Since we began at the start of the pandemic, we have had the privilege, and the responsibility of sharing the stories of our doctors and nurses working at the jobs to which they've committed their lives for years. But as we know, this has not been an ordinary year, and we're going to focus on two doctors to bring that point home. In fact, you could say that the theme of this episode is going home. We have followed Dr. Yasmin Mia as she's made home visits in some of the most underserved neighborhoods in New York City. She's one of the few doctors in New York, or anywhere in the country for that matter, who still perform that time-honored practice of the house call. But we begin with the story of Paul Lynch, an anesthesiologist from Arizona who trained in New York City in the early 2000s and returned to New York to Bellevue Hospital, his old residency site, and one of the hotspots of the pandemic to help treat COVID patients. Unfortunately, he contracted the disease during his time here and became a patient himself. Paul first shared his story in episode 1, and we now reconnect with him after he returned home to Phoenix.
Paul Lynch, anesthesiologist, founder, Pain Doctor, Inc., Phoenix, Arizona.
Paul, it's great to see you. It's been many months since we last spoke. A lot has happened, of course. Give us a rundown of your continued adventure as you returned home.
Peter, thank you so much for having me on your program. What a crazy year, right?
Absolutely.
For each of us, what I think is so interesting about the COVID epidemic is everyone now has stories. Everyone has how it affected them, right? In the beginning, I think when we first started talking, I had like this unique knowledge of COVID and how it affected people, how high risk it was, how it was real, how it could kill you. And I felt like I had this information that I needed to get into people's hands. But today, we all have this knowledge. We all have this shared experience.
Let's start with you personally, your health. You know,
yeah.
You sort of left us with a cliffhanger in terms of your unexpected infection and the immediate symptoms and side effects. Now, you know, this many months out, how are you feeling? And how was your course between the time that you came home and now?
Peter, thanks for asking. It was, I think I got a fairly bad version of COVID. And as people have asked me for my description of, you know, how it affected me, you know, I just start by saying that the version that hit New York City in March and April, when I was there last year, I think was very different than the version that started to spread through the country as the year went on. You know, my theory is that as mutations have occurred, you know, most of the time mutations make something worse, not better. And so I think the version that hit New York tend to be a very virulent version. And that's what I got early on. And so, you know, I never felt like I was going to die. I was in the hotel room kind of taking care of myself, and my sats were low, probably 85 is about as low as they got. But it wasn't just 85 for a minute or two. It was consistently in the 80s for days. And so that was scary. And I think if it was a patient telling me that, I would have told him just to go to the hospital. But that was the last thing that I wanted to do, you know, having seen what I had seen.
Right.
And it was like the typical man, like, I don't need directions. I got this.
I could tough it out.
Yeah. Now, the funny thing was I was doing the videos,
yeah,
and I had a lot of followers around the country, and there were some of the videos that would get 50,000 views. And so I would talk about my experiences, and I got so much advice and a lot of people that cared about me. So they started sending zinc and hydroxychloroquine in the mail to me, and azithromycin and fluids, mm-hmm. and I was getting packages from all over. And so, you know, that was, it was really encouraging. I had a lot of friends in New York City that came and checked on me. And, you know, in those days, it was like lockdown, like something from a movie. We'd wear like all these masks and, you know, ventilators and stuff. And people would just like come to my door and drop it off and run away. Like I was infected, you know. And so, mm-hmm. you know, the immediate course, I felt okay. Like I knew I was pretty sick, but I didn't feel like I was dying. What was interesting was I just frankly didn't get better for at least 6 months. I was fatigued. I was having headaches. And then my lung function was still affected to the point that I went and kind of got worked up and saw my doctor and kind of trying to figure out, you know, what was going on with my lungs. And it all kind of came back fairly normal. But randomly, I would just feel like I couldn't breathe. And then I would check my sats and it was back in the 80s again in June and then again in July. And then I finally felt like I started to get better probably around October, and I got sick in April. So that was about 6 months later, I started to feel good. And I would say today I'm back to 100%.
Mm. Paul, I wanted to touch on that point you made earlier regarding the ferocity or virulence of the early strains in New York, as opposed to perhaps what has been going throughout the country in different regions. You know, we just have the concept of variants and specific mutations just entered the public consciousness, really, in the public conversation some months ago. As we know, viruses will continue to mutate during their course. Their main mission, of course, is to continue to live and to infect. So I find it very interesting that your theory that perhaps those early strains, the incredible strike along the East Coast and New York early, may have been due to the fact that the virus was particularly ferocious and virulent at that time. Do you think that's borne out by some of the data and the evidence and at least the way we've seen the disease progress?
Yeah, and I do lots of teaching videos on COVID, Peter, and I know I always start by saying, listen, I'm an anesthesiologist. I'm not an epidemiologist. I'm not an infectious disease expert. But, you know, I am a bit of a statistician and mathematician. I like to look at the numbers. And I just think that mathematically, what was happening in New York City and Wuhan before that and Northern Italy and even Spain, like if you looked at the first three or four hotspots, there was a much higher death rate. There were worse outcomes at almost every level. And so, for example, when I was in New York City, the city hospital system released that about 90% of patients that went to the ICU would end up dying. If you look at that data today, it's less than 50%. And I've seen it reported in the news several times that doctors have got better at treating it. But I just don't think that's true. I know there's no, we're not really doing anything that much different today than we were doing back then. We were intubating.
Maybe not intubating as quickly. You know, that might be a one of the protocol shifts that might account for some of that, perhaps.
Maybe, but the outcome point that I'm talking about is a patient that's already been intubated and sent to the ICU. Mm-hmm. And so it's two patients. If you waited longer, you would theorize that they're actually sicker today. And so we're seeing people die less. That once they get intubated, they're more likely to get extubated. At every age range that people are less likely to die. I don't know if you remember some of the early reports coming out of Wuhan that was between 15 and 20% of patients over 80 would die. And we're seeing it much lower than that today. So my anesthesiologist theory is that as it's mutated, the virus has actually got better. And it's consistently got better throughout the year. And now we definitely are seeing a few variants like the B.1.1.7 variant out of Brazil that are worse. I still don't even think they touch the original version that was hitting in February, March, and April of last year.
So as you mentioned, as the CEO of your company, you head back to Arizona, you're nowhere near your peak functional status, but you were also responsible for keeping the show on the road. How were you able to manage that, given all the demands that you had on your time, as well as the limitations of your strength and your ability to crank throughout the course of what probably for you is a generally very busy and long day?
You know, when I talk about, we each have our story. My story, it was like, I felt like I was running the business with my foot on the brake for 1 year. And when I say for 1 year, I finally feel like we're starting to come out of COVID in Arizona. Matter of fact, last week, we had several days where our positivity rate was less than 1%. Mm. So we would test one day last Thursday, over 30,000 people, and only 280 came back positive. So I finally, having seen what I saw in New York, feel comfortable starting to really grow the business. But for a year, even though I'm a CEO and I report to a board and I have responsibilities, I feel like I've been trying not to grow the business. Mm. And it's a weird thing. So we, to go back in time and describe a little bit more what I'm saying, when I went to New York City, I shut down all of our clinics, 100% shutdown. And I did 100% telehealth for around 60 days. And during that time, I went to New York and I worked. For me, it was, what would I do for my own mom or dad? And at that time, you know, we know a lot more today, but at that time, we just weren't sure. And we were seeing the 15 to 20% death rates in people 80 years old. So I told my dad, who works for me, he's 71. I said, do not come to work until I say it's okay. And so I sent him home. As a matter of fact, my dad, he showed up to work. And I remember, this was before I went to New York. I remember sitting there on a phone call and I saw my dad get out of his car like he was walking in. This was maybe March 15th. And I hung up the call and I ran over to my dad and I was like, go home. Trust me on this. This is a big deal. Go home. This is March 15th before a lot of people were talking about it. What I thought is if that's the way I would treat my own dad, that was panicked that he would walk into the clinic and get COVID and die. Mm-hmm. If that's the way I would treat my own dad, then I have an obligation to treat every single patient that exact same way. And pain is a serious issue, and there are people suffering, and I feel an obligation to help them, but I also feel an obligation to protect them. And so we shut everything down, and we saw everyone by telehealth, but that meant we had to lay off 80% of our staff. It was a very, very stressful time. And then in the midst of that, I went to New York, and in the midst of that, I got sick. And so I was sick, recuperating, quarantined in a hotel room, and then I came home and quarantined in my own house by myself, while my business, you know, I thought was probably going to go bankrupt. That's what I thought was going to happen. And what was crazy, Peter, is any time I could end it, at any time I could just, I was the CEO. Mm-hmm. I made the decisions.
Right.
And so at any time I could say, you know what? This virus isn't real. We're opening up. We're going to do all these procedures again. We're going to make money again because we're very procedural driven practice, you know, interventional pain. So
right.
A lot of our revenue would come from procedures.
Right. There's no telehealth option for epidurals or nerve blocks. You can't really be doing that remotely. You know,
it was impossible.
Not yet. Impossible. So, not yet. Yeah.
So we, not yet. Thank you. Yeah, that'll be the next podcast.
Robotics. Yeah.
But we shut down, probably decreased revenue by 80%. We had to lay off 80% of our staff or furlough them. And I could make the decision anytime. And keep in mind, we're in Arizona. And this is what was so weird about the dilemma. In California and New York and some other states, these decisions were made by third parties, but not in Arizona. Mm. In Arizona, there was no mask mandate. In Arizona, there was a very short period of shutdown, but it had no teeth, and it really, Arizona is quite a interesting place to live from that perspective.
Right.
And so I was making the decisions to keep the clinic shut down. And then I had to slowly make decisions throughout the year. And I had other advisors and other people that I talked to, but they usually said, we're going to defer to you because you saw it on the front lines. You know more than everyone. If you think we still need to stay shut down, we will. And so I typically left everything shut down a whole lot longer than any of our competition. And it was a very, very difficult summer. And then we started to reopen again. And then we got hit with a second wave in Arizona. And so we shut everything down again. So
right.
I would just say, as a CEO and feeling like I had a duty to my employees and to our shareholders, it was hard balancing with that with protecting patients' lives.
Dr. Yasmin Mia, director of the East Harlem Free Clinic at Mount Sinai, New York City.
So, you know, you have a perspective that's, I think, unique in that you've been doing the free clinic for a long period of time. You've been seeing patients in their homes, which is not a lost art. It's the way it used to be, the classic notion of a doctor doing that. But right now, all of us are realizing, and I put that in quotes, that there are these basic inequities in terms of the delivery of healthcare. Obviously, the pandemic has brought that to the fore. The more recent protest and that dialogue has strengthened that. You're not surprised by the discovery that patients are not treated equally in this country.
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, I basically live it every day. I see it every single day in everything that I do. I mean, it's almost like my career was sort of built on fixing inequities and increasing access. So it's not only very familiar, it's glaringly apparent. And it's something that I think our medical students in particular are very well versed in, and yet feel that really their only way to sort of address it, or at least address it comprehensively, is really as medical students. And once they go out into the world and they become residents and attendings, one of their concerns has been, you know, how do I not be part of the problem? And it's hard for them, you know, in retrospect, they realize that the free clinic in some ways was sort of a bubble, right? It's sort of, it's a place where you can, because we're not billing, because we're all sort of very like-minded, you know, we all can sort of fight with the sense of, I mean, almost entitlement to things that are given to us by the hospital or by the community that, you know, other people sort of feel like, a lot of people ask us, like, how do you get these things? And we sort of feel like we're entitled to these things, or our patients are entitled to these things because we're doing the right thing. And then our students go out into the world and they realize that things are not, like, so unfair. And
right.
solutions that we had worked out in the free clinic were really so novel and yet not necessarily reproducible.
Paging Dr. Zahos. Dr. Zahos.
Yasmin graduated from Harvard Medical School and trained at the Mount Sinai Hospital for residency. With these prestigious credentials, she could have secured some well-appointed office in the halls of academic medicine. But an early interest in the problem of healthcare inequity and a desire to make a difference led her to establish the East Harlem Outreach Program, where she and her team provide care to those most in need, patients often unwilling or unable to get to a doctor's office or a hospital. She brings compassionate medical care into the home. And if you think that's easy, well, listen as she takes us through one such patient encounter, start to finish.
So I'm about to walk in. Heat index is about 100 degrees right now, and it is stifling under this mask and behind my goggles. I am feeling quite nauseated, actually, as I make my way into the apartment building. I know that there is no air conditioning, and so I'm really dreading this. So it's a Wednesday morning. I'm heading into East Harlem from my home to see a longtime patient of mine who suffers from metastatic cancer and stage heart failure and pulmonary disease. And I'm going to see her in her likely sweltering apartment with multiple grandkids scrambling about. And I'm going to actually not just see her, but her son, who is also quite elderly and has become more and more debilitated over the past several months as a result of metastatic cancer of his own that everyone has recently found out about. It's been a very complex social situation. He's actually not my patient, and she is. She is requesting that I take over his care as well. And this is going to be a very complicated mess, if I can put it simply. But that's my goal. This is not unlike any other house call in which I walk in and you never know what's behind the door. So let's see. Elevator now, and it's actually a little bit cooler in here, so I can get my mind together before I go in.
Because I looked and I saw they were going bad, and I said, well, I'm going to try it. And most some of that.
Don't worry, I'm coming for your I do my own dirt.
Yeah.
So I use fruits and stuff, because you know.
She says she
fertilizer.
Let me see.
So I tell everybody that go to their house, I take their garbage. Because this is fertilizer.
Oh, you mean like composting?
Compost.
Yeah, I gotcha. Okay.
Compost.
Yeah. Compost. Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
Instead
yeah.
of throwing it away, I take it home and I build more
compost. I told her she get green tomatoes. I love green tomatoes. I used to have a friend that used to have a garden. So when I was pastoring upstate, I had a garden.
I'm doing red
and
tomatoes.
And I love the fried green tomatoes.
Yeah, yeah.
But I can't have a garden here, so I haven't had them in a long time.
Why not do it on your porch?
I'm kidding.
I don't have a porch.
I know, on the windowsill. I'm kidding. All right.
Jose does it on his windowsill.
Who's Jose?
The Spanish guy that comes over here all the time and fixes the air conditioning.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Okay, yeah. Some people will do it on the roof. Let me check your blood pressure.
My blood pressure was good. They took it a while ago.
Just today?
Yeah.
The nurse came?
They did.
Which nurse? Which nurse was it?
People care nurse.
Oh, the people care nurse. Okay.
From the new
agency.
Yeah.
Gotcha. All right. Let me check.
I'm going to do it this side, because this is the side of the breast cancer, so I don't like.
And Dr. Mia, I had a little pain up in there. Is that the heart or is that breast?
Okay, when did you get it?
The other night.
What were you doing when it happened?
Laying down.
Just laying down.
Yelling at Tony.
And corn.
Whatever come out of it, you know. Tomatoes, beets, and corn, and just some flour.
But don't forget the green tomatoes. I love that.
Thank you, Dr. Can you let me know things that I have to watch out for? Absolutely, yes. So the one thing I'm a little bit concerned about is how swollen this leg is. And so what I'm going to do is do something called a Doppler. They'll come here to the house, you'll do it on ultrasound of her leg to see if there's a clot there. Do you feel short of breath?
No. Morning, you know, my asthma went
through
a lot.
And we restarted your diuretic. I put it in the new blister pack. Did you start the blister pack yet?
Yeah.
You did? Okay. I'm going to just double check that in a minute. No speeches. If there are any questions, I'll ask.
Just the way I like to run. Do you mind cutting that noise off? And I said I'll buy a Tony one. A speaker so they wouldn't argue over Joel's.
And
you ready for a bath?
Yeah.
Watch when you
out. Everything is ready for you, okay?
Are you dizzy when you stand up?
I don't think so.
I'm not getting a great
blood pressure. I was closing the door, but keep opening it so he don't want the door.
And don't put your head in that water.
It's 105 on the 6th. That's your baseline. You're good. Let me see your new blister box. Do you have the new one?
Yeah, and I didn't want to just put that in the garbage. And I say, maybe you know they some way they could use it, or...
We can't. They have to be, these have to be thrown out now. It's fine. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
I'll go ahead and put it in the garbage. I didn't
Or you can give it, you can just throw it in the garbage. That's fine. And don't put it down the toilet. Or, no, just throw it in. You can put it in the incinerator. That's fine. Just put it in the incinerator.
I just put the whole bag in there.
So it doesn't hurt when you bend this ankle. Bend it up. Up, yeah. And then
that hurt a little bit.
That hurts a little bit. Okay. Yeah, this is way more swollen than when I last saw you last week. So it was a little swollen last time, but this is way more swollen.
Yeah.
So I'm going to need to get a Doppler, right? So that's the ultrasound of the leg.
Okay.
They can do it here. You could do it in the hospital.
No, do it here.
Yeah,
because now with Mike's not here, I have to get somebody to watch the boys.
Yeah, it's too much. Yeah.
And I
have you spoken to Michael?
Not since yesterday.
And what did he say?
He just wanted to know how I was doing, and I told him I was doing fine. I said, I'm sending you some food, because he had told the guy he had called him and told him he was hungry.
Okay.
So I sent him some food and told him we was fine, and we are fine.
Yeah, it's probably better if he's not bad.
Yeah.
Do you want me to talk to the hospital about admitting him to hospice?
Yes.
Okay. Why don't I work on that?
Please.
They called me on Friday because he didn't show up to his clinic appointment.
He didn't? But he can't hardly get, and then he don't have no aid.
What is electromagnetic radiation?
I don't think it's good for him to come back home.
I don't think it's good for him to come back home. Because if he gets sick or something in the night, I can't.
Is he walking around?
He's still walking, but Dr. Mia, he's just dragging. And then he'd be still trying to smoke, make me so mad. And he couldn't even light the cigarette.
If you took the world's...
And then the other night, I stayed woke all night because I didn't want him in there trying to light a cigarette and set the bed on fire and leave me and these kids in here.
Oh, my God. Okay. So let me do this. I'm going to go across the street in a little bit. I'm going to go see him.
Okay.
And I'm going to talk to him about not coming home.
And tell him I'm doing fine, because we are doing fine.
I think...
I want to see Grandpa.
You want to see Grandpa?
You can probably visit him, okay?
But I think today... So here's the thing. I think he's not feeling so good.
You can't go visit Grandpa today.
Yeah, not today,
maybe we'll
but another
do,
time, right?
We'll do a, you know, like we do with
duo.
Mike, a duo, yeah.
Well, he
duo?
Never answers his video call.
Dr. Doyle once called me and told me to look at my chart on my phone, and I ain't found my chart.
This is a selection of some of Yasmin's audio diaries over the past year, many of them on site at the point of care. You'll hear that the job really hasn't gotten any easier, even if the pandemic has ebbed.
I am reflecting today on some incredibly difficult decisions that I've had to make over the past week regarding several patients who I would normally not hesitate to admit to the hospital because of conditions that are incredibly complex and achieving great acuity in terms of progression. And just how difficult these conversations and how tense they were in the past week to really drive the decision to ultimately admit these patients to the hospital. Reflecting back, I realize that though the pandemic is really no longer at fever pitch in the New York area, the fear is certainly still very prevalent. What that means for the families, for the home attendants, and for the patients themselves in terms of mortality and contagiousness. Today was a difficult day. I spent almost 2 hours on the phone with a family member, her mother, and another family member trying to decide if it made sense to admit this patient who was going into progressive renal failure. After several hours back and forth with my patient and her family member, we went back and forth and back and forth and ultimately decided to bring her into the hospital. I arranged for an ambulance and the emergency room to be prepped to accept her. And then I got a text from the family member saying that we've decided to reverse her decision. Could you call me back? And in that moment, although I very much suspected it would go in this direction, I think there was this sense of just complete exhaustion and also just sorrow. And I guess just some, I don't want to say I'm dispassionate at all, but I do feel sorry for this family, but not in the way I think I would have before the pandemic. What I saw in the hospital, I think, has made me a little more hardened, a little less emotional and emotionally connected to my patients and their families. I don't feel the same sort of sadness anymore. I think, frankly, just traumatized. I think now I'm a little numb and I want so much to feel empathy, but I'm sort of throwing up my hands a little bit. Not because I'm angry, not at all. I get it. I understand where they're coming from, but because I'm just tired. And I know that they think that they're damned if they bring their family member in and damned if they don't. Now that COVID seems like it's over, I know it really isn't. I'm seeing and hearing about stories from patients, from friends, from colleagues of just how prolonged this illness really is. For so many of my healthier patients or my patients who are younger, I'm seeing tragic loss of life in the functional sense, a lingering of symptoms, of fatigue, of a general sense of insecurity, a shortness of breath that comes and goes, a sense of doom. And it's really frustrating because I don't think I know enough.
Paul Lynch, anesthesiologist, founder, Pain Doctor, Inc., Phoenix, Arizona.
Let me switch gears a little bit and ask you about the vaccination efforts in Arizona and whether your practice, your staff, is helping in terms of educating your patients in terms of the need for the vaccine. Is there hesitancy on that side? You know, if everybody wants to get back to normal and also be able to have the full spectrum of treatment that you can provide, there are a few other options for them. Are you involved in that effort?
Yeah, for sure. So as the year went on, Peter, I felt like when I got back from New York, I couldn't let go. I felt like in the beginning, I had like this specialized knowledge that could help people. And I had been, you know, I'm a pain management doctor, and I've been fighting against this opioid epidemic for about 15 years now. And we, at one point, we started tracking how many lives that we felt like we had saved mathematically, just based on our protocols versus the standard of care. And so the data shows that about 1 in 500 patients who take pain pills every day, that it will be their cause of death. 1 in 500. And that's actually really bad, right? That's a lot of death for a medication that we throw around. And so we tracked how many patients we had saved by all the patients we got off. And we calculated a couple years ago that we were getting close to 1,000 lives that we had saved between practices we managed in Arizona and Texas and Nevada around the country. And I was super proud of that number. I think about 1,000 people that we had saved with our policies. When I came back from New York, I realized I might be able to save thousands of lives just by educating, just by teaching and getting someone to change their behavior. And I could do it from the comfort of my home at night just by educating. So that's what I started doing. And so I started doing videos, and I would talk about what I saw. And it was hard for me to let go. And it was at a time that we weren't doing procedures, and I actually had more time. And so I would weekly do videos. And so as we came into the fall, I realized two things. One, these vaccines were going to save millions and millions of lives, number one. And number two, that the way we communicate with people was going to be so key. In August, there were some polls, and at one point it was less than 50% of people, less than 50% was said they would get a vaccination. I think one poll was like 42% said they would get vaccinated. And I felt an overwhelming importance that I needed to learn to communicate with people. And it wasn't about shaming them or yelling at them or beating into their head that they have to get a vaccine. You need to meet people where they're at. And so I just started thinking, how can I help with my own particular voice, my own particular brand of communication to tell people this is okay? They need to get vaccinated. And even needs the wrong word. That at the end of the day, if they had a long conversation with their doctor and they balanced the risk and the benefits, they would realize that the vaccinations were the right thing for them to do.
Being in Arizona, are you noticing there's obviously a political cast or bias to that?
Yeah.
You know, again, that's for, you know, men of science like ourselves, it's very hard to understand how that bleeds into this question, but it does. Does that add another layer of complicated discussion, or particularly trying to reach out to those folks that for any of a number of reasons, many of them misinformed, feel that the virus isn't real or the vaccine is a scam or any of these theories that are out there?
Yeah, this is almost like therapy talking to you, Peter, because these are things, as the years gone on, I said multiple times, you know, I'm a doctor, I'm not a Republican or a Democrat, because I realize if I identify with a party or if I criticize one party or the other, then 50% of people turn their brain off to me, and I just want to be a physician. But then around December, I said, you know what, I actually want to talk politics for one of my videos. I just want to talk about Republicans and Democrats and what they believe and why. And I would almost even go deeper with you, Peter. I grew up in the South in Kentucky, and I grew up a Republican, and I grew up a Protestant Christian. And as I, you know, got older and as COVID hit, I realized all the people that I grew up with, the Southern Republican Christians, for whatever reason, they got sucked into a narrative that was just really off base on COVID and on vaccinations and on other things. And so to your point, there was a poll released last week that showed 90% of Democrats say that they're going to get vaccinated or have, and only 50% of Republicans. And that's shocking to me as a physician, as a lifelong Republican, that 50% of the party believes that this is not right for them. And so, but once again, instead of criticizing or making fun, or I feel like it's my job as a physician to break through those barriers. I feel like if I could really sit with the 50% that didn't want to get vaccinated and hear them and understand and talk with them, that I could help them.
I think you're really onto something there, Paul. You know, we're so used to anyone that is used to having these impossible, difficult conversations with patients, but knowing that there's a line from the diagnosis, the discussion, the procedure, the post-op will get you through it because we have the, you know, the track record to know that that's what can be done. I think the idea of enlisting doctors across the range to be able to get this message out, you know, maybe this doctor won't vibe with that particular group of people, but if there are enough of us doing that same mission, maybe we can make a difference. I mean, let's use, you know, these kind of outlets as a way to do that. I really support that effort because it's so easy to go to turn it off. I don't want to hear that person's way of thinking because it maddens me. But you're right. Then nothing changes. We're all in the same little silo.
There was a famous psychoanalyst that came right after Freud named Erickson. Mm-hmm. And he talked about the key to psychoanalysis or to really any therapeutic relationship with a patient was unconditional positive regard. I think if we can show them unconditional positive regard, reflect back to them that they have reasons to be afraid, that they have reasons to be scared, that they have reasons not to distrust everything the government says, that it's okay to question, but help them through that process to help someone find the answers, that you can actually break through some of this. We've gone from about around 45% of people that say they would get vaccinated to 70% over 6 months. And I think that's a real step in the right direction. And I think we are pushing up against what I call the 30%, but you know, I'm hoping we can get another 5 or 10% over the next 6 months that'll get vaccinated, because we are going into a new era. We may need to get vaccinated every year against COVID for the next 10 years. This might be part of our lifestyle. So, but I think it's super important that we show unconditional positive regard to those that are afraid of vaccinations, because they're not just crazy. They have good reasons to be worried.
That's right. All the, you know, the science is in place. The infrastructure is in place. Companies that are competitors are working together for production. You're right. It's absolutely, you know, unparalleled.
Right.
Is that the way that we can filter out all the white noise that comes from political parties or from various news sources with incorrect, sketchy, dangerous information? It's an optimistic, probably naive notion that people can just revel in the beauty of the scientific method and this effort. But, you know, it's worth a try.
Yeah. Well, it's exciting to me. And you can feel free to cut this part out of your podcast. But I think as I read the science, the thing that's the most interesting to me right now and has got me almost blocked on Facebook when I talk about it is gain of function research. Mm-hmm. And how did these scientists get so good at coming up with a vaccine so quickly? And it's the scary underside of all this is that every major industrialized country in the world is working on making viruses worse. It's almost like the new nuclear arms race. And it's maybe not the right topic for your show, but it's something I've been reading a lot about and just super fascinated that one of the reasons we're so good at it is because we're doing this behind the scenes so that if someone ever releases a virus on us, we can fight it.
No, I mean, you're right. It's the dark side of that happy talk I just mentioned, the idea that, you know, in these labs, these things are happening. And of course, that does lead us back to like how it all happened. But look, we got to look at all sides of this. You know, it's not nothing has been in a vacuum, and we don't know where the next one will come from. And so we have to be vigilant. Right. And be smart. I'm with you on that too, even though you're
episode
right.
Episode 3 or 4. We'll talk about gain of function research.
Exactly. It's not as uplifting perhaps as some of the earlier stuff. But Paul, it's great seeing you. I'm really happy that you're not only on the mend, but it sounds like you're kind of back in fine fettle and all that, and that the businesses, you survived what, you know, others might not have been able to get through, given all the hits that came your way. So we're all really very happy for you. We look forward to checking in with you periodically and delving into some of these other topics in the future. But I really thank you very much for joining us today.
Peter, thank you so much for having me. Thank you for the good work you're doing. It's great being on your show.
Do you ever not feel welcome at in-house calls? Is there ever a point where you know, there's some uncertainty? I mean, you're in tough neighborhoods, you know, and a lot of varied factors. Have you ever been in a situation that you felt uncomfortable in that way?
I wouldn't say it's very common.
I mean, look, that's pretty dramatic, you know?
Yeah.
Where were you? And, you know, walk me into the elevator.
Yeah. So this was maybe 15 years ago in a walk-up building. Mm-hmm. And I had met the patient several times. The patient was actually disabled, but was a vet and actually had a number of guns on his person. Yeah.
You'd seen him before.
Oh, yeah. I'd seen him a couple times before, but I had actually felt increasingly uncomfortable going to the home. Mm-hmm. One, because he was a little bit of a loose cannon. I mean, he was not, you know, wasn't terribly friendly. I wasn't really sure what I was doing there because half the time he wouldn't even let me examine him. And so I'll never forget the time I went with a medical student. The agenda was we were going to ask him to ensure that his guns were locked away in a cabinet before I came in. And again, I mean, this is a guy who was paraplegic. The apartment was pretty dingy. The door was ajar. I knocked. He said, come in. And I said, I don't want to open it unless I know there's no guns on your person. And he said, no, there are no guns on my person. And I opened the door and I remember holding the door open with my foot and saying to the medical student, you need to just stand behind me, right? Just, I don't have a good feeling about this, but.
But you put the medical student behind
you. Yeah, but I put this medical student behind me, right? So when I walked in, he said he didn't have a gun on my on his person. I said, no, you do. You have them on your, they're in your belt. And he's like, what, these? And we took him out and started
going. He had two six shooters.
And I wasn't sure if I should laugh or I should run. So I said, listen, I'm going to be leaving. And he said, why? Where are you going? But he still has guns, like, pointed at me. And I was like, you know what? I'm out. So we left. But, you know, that, I have to say, was semi-comical because I knew I could run. I more felt just terrible that I brought a medical student in. And I remember thinking, you know, the one thing about visiting doctors and the house call program in general is that it's very isolating. Like, you're out there by yourself a lot. We often don't have an escort. And right now with COVID, we don't have anybody with us, right? And especially when you've been doing this for so long, you know, you sort of get, I don't even have a sense of fear, right? And that's a good thing because I can do my job. A kid gets shot in the projects. I had come out of a patient's home with a medical student and I saw it. I mean, I didn't see who shot him, but I could hear it. And then I saw a kid braced against a fence and he had been shot in the leg. So it was clearly a warning shot, right? And I ran up to him and he's like, he shot me. And I said, you know what, let me get you down on the ground. We've got to place an IV. Like, I don't know. I think in my head, I was like, okay, how do I respond to a trauma? And I remember screaming out, somebody call 911. And it was like, everybody left because you don't want to be in a situation where anyone can identify you. And this happened to be one of the biggest drug shootings in East Harlem, but I didn't know it at the time, right? So I had a medical student with me trying to tourniquet the leg. All of a sudden I thought, you know, it was like one of those like moments of like situational awareness. And then I was like, you know what? I can't have you here. You need to get out of here. One, I don't know if the shooter's around. I don't know if he's in another building. And I think I need to leave this. I can't be in these projects. And so I sent the medical student off. I was like, thank you for helping me, but you have to get out of here. Like, just go the other way. And I just stayed there until the ambulance arrived, which, of course, you know, they say in the report was 2 minutes, and I know it was 15.
So I just saw my patient, who I've been taking care of for a very long time, who suffers from pretty advanced diabetes and multiple sclerosis, and is having a recurrence of significant abdominal pain. And although I can attribute by some degree of this to his advanced diabetes and his multiple sclerosis, I think a lot of this actually has to do with his stubbornness and his terrible diet. And so we just spent the last 20 minutes, myself, him, and I pulled his brother onto the phone to really almost lecture him about his terrible diet and his self-sabotaging behavior. And it's for our frustration with his overall state and how I just don't feel like I can manage him. And yet I know I can, which, by the way, has been our relationship for almost 15 years. Usually it takes me coming in very frequently, almost on a weekly basis, if not every 2 weeks, and ultimately getting to a point where I realize that he really needs to take control or take ownership over his own care. So the only way to get what I need to get done, which is to lecture him and to really point out what the problems are and how I can't be the everything. I can't throw medications at him. I can't do the imaging and call it a day. It takes more than just pharmacotherapeutics. It takes more than insulin. It takes more than me coming in. He needs to take control. And I know he can do it.
Paging Dr. Zahos. Dr. Zahos.
In the early 1930s, House calls accounted for nearly half of doctor-patient meetings. By the 1980s, it was less than 1%. Going on a house call is like going back in time for a doctor, without access to all the modern technology of a hospital or office. But for patients who are too frail to travel, or too isolated from the system for one reason or another, the house call can be a lifeline. But they pose unique challenges and personal strain to any medical practitioner, and we thank Dr. Mia for sharing her experience with us. We look forward to bringing you into the lives of our doctors and nurses again next time on The Life Medical, and we will return to our recurring feature, Citizen Science, and our continuing conversation with neuroscientist Dr. Adam Ghazali. This is Dr. Peter Zahos, and I look forward to being with you next time on The Life Medical.
The Life Medical is written, executive produced, and hosted by Dr. Peter Zahos. The series is produced, edited, and mixed by DDR Stewart. Music from MusicBed, with additional music from Premium Beat.